Hello and welcome to your friendly neighborhood libertarian. I'm your host, Isidore Johnson, and today on the show, we have the founder of the MIT Political Review, Chase Reed. It's nice to see you, Chase. How are you doing on this Thursday?
Thank you for having me on. I'm doing quite well. It's been a great week, a very eventful week, especially with everything that's going on in politics. But above all, thank you for having me on. It's great to talk to you. It's great to engage with somebody across the aisle and have a really productive discussion.
Yes, of course. So I was scrolling through your editor-in-chief message, and a big thing that you argued was that we cannot be unmoored from the greater societal context. Do you think that as a result of this, there's going to be a lot of punditry about the election in your journal? And can you just give me like a little bit of a rundown about what you want to do with it?
Sure, certainly. So yeah, I think that, one of the reasons, we're creating this journal and we're in the process of developing this is because we're actually really tired of the punditry. We see on Twitter, we see on Facebook, we see on CNN. We feel as though a lot of these discussions are very superficial, very hollow, very surface level. They're just saying something that riles people up that is by and large acceptable by the large broad stroke of the population, but doesn't necessarily dive any deeper than that. All across social media, all across the internet, for example, you'll find conversations which are, back and forths, maybe one or two sentences. I feel this is a disservice to politics. I think this is really a disservice to political, philosophical, whatever you have it thought, because it really neglects diving deeper into the issues. And I know a lot of these platforms don't lend themselves to large discussions or cerebral discussions, but I do think that something that we want to do as a publication is to diverge, I guess, from what the mainstream media, so to speak, is doing and provide more of a cerebral analysis of politics that is different from just partisan back and forth and partisan squabbles, and more something that's well-developed and perhaps draws upon different influences rather than American media and American politics.
Okay, so I guess this like begs the question. So like, why is American media so bad?
Right, yes. Yeah, so I think that one of the pitfalls of American media, I guess, is just how it's operated in a sense. A lot of media publications, especially with the, I guess, erosion of local journalism, a lot of it is there's a really clear profit motive. And I think that, when it comes to profit motives, you're going to do whatever increases your margins, whatever, drives people to your show, to your publication, to your journal, whatever it may be. And I think that what really plays best with people is something that just confirms their pre-existing conceptions, their preconceptions about the world. A lot of publications I see oftentimes don't try to tread an unpopular line, rather they try to say something that people already believe in and just confirm those beliefs. And that brings people to the publication. People like to see their beliefs confirmed. They like to see, second or third sources saying, hey, I agree with you, you're actually right about this subject. But it doesn't allow people to, I guess, necessarily break free from their own ideological constraints. People, if you're only considering what you believe and not venturing out to unknown territory and, engaging the beliefs that are not yours, or maybe even challenge your beliefs, then I think people are doing themselves a disservice. But unfortunately, our media, they have bills to pay. They have, viewership ratings, all those things to keep up. And I think by doing that, they're just going to go for the easy, low-hanging fruit, which is to appeal to what people already believe in, what people's convictions already are, rather than challenging them.
So about this, though, it seems like media has been for profit for quite some time. Is there a reason why right now profit motives are bad, or is it simply like just a particularly competitive time in American media?
Right. Yeah. I think that, I think what happened pretty much is there's been a lot of consolidation, I think, in media. Back in like the 1960s, 1970s, like every single town had their own journal. And the reason those journals were able to sustain themselves is because there was a lot of local businesses, and they could sustain themselves purely based on advertising revenue. That isn't necessarily the truth anymore, because in a lot of these businesses, especially local businesses, have either become chain businesses or have been, have closed up shop, and that has only accelerated in the past few years. A lot of the businesses that went asunder, during the last recession, a significant, considerable portion, not all, not a majority, but a considerable portion never came back. And I think that dries up local ad revenue, which in turn makes it that a lot of these media publications either have to sustain themselves through other means or have to just feed themselves into some larger, for-profit corporation or for-profit entity. And I think that, this changing of the industrial organization, this changing of the actual industry of media itself, creating more consolidated enterprises, consolidated entities, I think that has definitely exacerbated this effect. I also think that the, you know, the availability, like it used to be advertising dollars. Now it's about, you know, how many clicks you can get. I think it's a little bit different in the sense that, you know, that main stream of revenue with the digitization of news, with the drying up of local journalism has made it so it's almost a different type of profit motive. Also, I think that, you know, a lot of the revenue streams you might've had 10, 20, even maybe even 30 years ago, either don't exist or aren't enough to sustain a publication. So you have to look for other ways to do it. And I think that, you know, all these, I guess, second order effects, all these things that happen outside of journalism itself, like the erosion of small businesses and local businesses, have produced a type of media that really just doesn't, you know, examine or even do any challenging of people's convictions, but rather does what immediately results in the highest profits to keep them afloat ultimately.
Okay, so I want to challenge this because I'm a little skeptical of this perspective, in that it seems like a lot of even the most popular like magazines and journals are trying to toe the party line. Like for example, like we've seen the New York Times oust a couple really prominent journalists,
right?
But it seems like that's really hurting their bottom line in like the medium to long term. Do you think that instead of like I'm trying to like build upon your view rather than like completely destroy it. Do you think that this is more the result of the middleman like being like the publication being significantly weakened in favor of like individual journalists? I'm thinking about like Ezra Klein in this analysis, maybe Andrew Sullivan, Matt Taibbi. Like instead of seeing newspapers, we're seeing journalists, and that might lead to a different sort of thing. Or am I not understanding your perspective?
Yeah, I think you'd really definitely have hit the nail on the head on in some way. I think that, you know, you see a lot of these, you know, journalists who are particularly popular with the publications kind of charting their own course and creating their own entities and, you know, their own, I guess, journalistic endeavors themselves. I think that, number one, I think first and foremost, I think that's been a net positive almost because it does allow them to kind of break rank with the overwhelming consensus in those publications. Like you saw the New York Times letting go a lot of their editors and their writers because they're, you know, not towing the line of the New York Times, or they might be coming out in contradiction to what the New York Times believes in. I think that allowing them to chart their own course does grant them a degree of autonomy that ultimately is better for our polity. I think if we have more voices, it can be good, provided that, you know, of course there's a caveat there with so many voices, it becomes difficult to, you know, differentiate between what's good information and what information is of low quality. But I do think that it's healthy for discourse if there are more voices involved, rather than kind of having like four different mainstream media groups, all of which have their own ideological stripes, and you have to pick between those four. You know, yeah. It really eliminates the element of choice. But I think that having people who kind of break rank, like Ezra Klein, for example, with Vox, I think that's ultimately.
Okay, so I guess I'm going in for like what I would think would be the killer blow on your original argument, which is that it would seem that profit motive is what encouraged this independence and or thing to create or to exist. So would it not be the case that like the profit motive has largely made American news a lot better as opposed to the dogmatic slumber it would have beforehand?
Right. I think that I honestly want to say that profit motive was probably not what, for example, made a lot of these publishers, a lot of these writers divorce themselves from their previous publications, their previous homes. I feel like, you know, just from reading what a lot of these people have to say about what made them, you know, go on and create their own publications, it seems a lot of it has to do with just purely autonomy, being able to kind of write freely. And I can kind of empathize with that. You know, when you're part of a publication, kind of have to keep up appearances, you have to maintain a certain level, a certain standard, and you kind of have to almost, I want to say, you know, pigeonhole your views and kind of conform them to what the views of the publication are. Whereas when you have your own independent journal, you kind of have free reign, you kind of have free ownership. It's almost kind of like a lot of those you know, Google engineers who go on to find their own startups because they're just not enchanted with the work that Google's doing. They kind of want to do something that really enchants them. So I think that while profit motive might play an effect in that, I think by and large, the real motive for the real, you know, causal, you know, impetus there was probably just wanting more, you know, autonomy, wanting to specialize in a certain sector of news, and ultimately wanting to kind of break rank from like the ideological consensus of the respective publications.
That's really cool. So, keeping with that tradition in mind, are you trying to move your MIT Political Review to be a certain type of publication? And what sort of publication do you see your review is trying to do?
Yeah. So honestly, I think that, I look at a lot of different reviews from different, colleges and universities. And as MIT, the actual university itself, we definitely have a streak for, being very scientifically minded, very mathematically minded. So in one sense, I do want us to be a journal that doesn't just, engage in, I feel this way, I feel that way, but kind of almost delve into a deeper analysis, almost a scientific analysis of the issues. At the same time, I think that this publication, I definitely wanted to be nonpartisan. I wanted to be a publication where every single idea can be encapsulated, because at MIT, you'll quickly find that, a certain voice rises to the top almost always, and it oftentimes can feel as though you're in an echo chamber. I know, being an MIT student, I do have a lot of views that are on the left, but I also have a lot of views that you would traditionally identify with the right, with conservatives. And I feel as though when you see MIT discourse, whether it be, in the dorms or online or on social media, a lot of what you see doesn't really maybe hint at the fact that there's so much ideological diversity at the university itself. And I think that as a publication, we want to kind of encapsulate that ideological diversity. We want to open the floor for people who may dissent from the overwhelming ideological consensus at MIT, but we also want to foster a healthy debate, because I think that oftentimes in the current forms where MIT students are talking about politics, it can feel overwhelming to be a conservative when there's a lot of liberals, and even vice versa, when there's, when you're in a club, for example, that's comprised mostly of conservatives, you might feel as though you're being dwarfed by them. I want to create a forum where every single person's voice is welcome, every single ideological view is welcome, but more so, I want to create a publication that is open to people who will dissent from whatever the overwhelming consensus is. Overwhelming consensus being the consensus of the pundits, the consensus of the mainstream media, people who are willing to offer perhaps unsavory and almost unorthodox opinions on issues. I want it to be a journal that really encapsulates almost everything there is when it comes to politics, philosophy, economics, whatever it may be at MIT, because I know there's a lot out there.
So about that, though, you mentioned that a lot of these ideas tend to continually rise to the top, and that there's sort of consistent strains in these. If this happens at the university writ large, why would it not happen at your journal?
Right. Yeah. So I think that when it comes to the voices that oftentimes rise in large part at the university itself, it's because, a lot of people who may feel differently are oftentimes afraid to speak in those social settings. I think there's a lot of social pressure to kind of conform to a certain viewpoint, especially at college and university. I think that's true almost every single university out there, bar a few. And I think that when you have the ability, almost the freedom to be removed from the social situations and offer your views and opinions through a framework that is less inclusive of social pressures, then I think people are more likely to say what's on their mind rather than what they think is going to earn them the most brownie points or save their reputation. So I think that having a publication that's kind of divorced from, the settings where political discourse usually happens gives people the opportunity to say what's on their mind without fearing, perhaps rebuke or fearing, social ostracism. So I think that that's one reason why I think we can almost cultivate a culture at the review that is encompassing of all voices, and why there will be more than just, one ideological streak represented, is because people will feel less afraid to do so. At least that's my hope. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, but that's definitely the type of environment we're trying to create, one that's really welcoming and inclusive of all voices.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm a little bit confused about is, it seems if you're arguing that you're not able to be unmoored from your greater societal context, it would seem that these trends would likely continue regardless. For example, I've said some things that if enough people read them would probably make me a little bit of a pariah on campus.
Right.
And I'm wondering, why would that not just happen just a little bit? Would it just be that people have to actually read the political review first?
Right. Yeah. I think that it's a large degree that, number one, it's going to definitely be tailored to a certain type. Now, ultimately, my goal is for have every single person at MIT read that, but I know that's very big aspiration considering the type of people who go to MIT. A lot of people just plainly don't care about politics. And I think the real big goal is to get those people involved and interested in it. But realistically speaking, it's going to appeal to, not a tiny cross-section of the MIT populace, but definitely a niche cross-section of the MIT populace. So number one, there's that fear that it's the, I guess, loss of the fear that you're going to be ostracized by the entirety of campus. Among political circles on campus, people are a little bit more, I want to say, welcoming of other views. If you think about campus as being kind of just like the entirety of it, everybody, even those who are non-political, you might get some backlash for reviews. But if you're talking to political people, they're going to be more understanding about, okay, I'm willing to tolerate talking to a conservative. I'm willing to entertain their views instead of just immediately shutting them down. I'm willing to talk to a libertarian instead of just immediately shutting them down. So I think the fact that our viewership or our readership is going to be a lot different than from, I guess, it's not going to be so much a microcosm of campus, so much as a microcosm of the political spheres and political groups on campus will make people a little less afraid to speak. But I also think that it's just that raw in the moment, I'm afraid to say my mind because of the people I'm around physically. I think that's a lot of the reasons why people don't, want to speak out, is because, that fear, being ostracized is a lot more palpable when you're in person. Whereas when you're online, you're able to say things a little bit more, I want to say, pep in your step and a little bit more with your chest pointed out, because you know that you won't immediately get, reprimanded by your social sphere in person. So I think both those factors are going to play into making it so that even just a marginal amount more of maybe heterodox voices are able to rise to the surface in the publication.
Yeah, regarding that, further, wouldn't the idea that heterodoxy is good in itself be a controversial axiom?
Right.
Like, how do you escape the trap of public reason liberalism that some people might reject?
Right, exactly. Liberalism? Yeah, totally, totally. I think that, yeah, it honestly, and when I say that we try to take a very neutral stance on things, I do realize that by saying, hey, we want to be welcoming heterodoxy, has kind of forfeit that. I want to say that the journal itself isn't necessarily going to endorse those views, merely opening the floor for those views to kind of fester and for people to read them and people to write about them. So in a sense, I personally, as an individual, removed from the review itself, I love reading and hearing from heterodox views. I encourage people to dissent. I encourage people to offer things that are unpopular. The review itself isn't necessarily going to say, hey, we, number one, not only like those views, but we want those views. Actually, we want exclusively those views. We're merely going to say, hey, if you have those views, this is a place and a platform for you to express them without necessarily fearing the type of backlash you get in person or fearing the ostracism, because we are going to be a platform that is inclusive and assigns an equal validity to all views, provided they're within a reasonable sphere. I mean, we don't want to be a publication that gets, totally reprimanded for having views that are just totally out there and abhorrent, but we do want to be inclusive of views that are maybe not popular and might err from the popular, undercurrents of political discourse at colleges and universities, which seems to be a very narrow chasm. We want to be more wide than that.
Yeah, I guess what I'm going for, though, is if something is considered abhorrent, then how much are we really living by John Stuart Mill's on liberty view of marketplace of ideas?
Right.
Where are your barriers?
So yeah, as a publication, I think the barriers, I ultimately, and I know it's very difficult to kind of tease out, okay, where does, what's the line between a view being just heterodox or unpopular, and that view just maybe stepping across a line where it's almost, saying, hey, certain people don't deserve to exist, or certain people are necessarily better than others based on the basis of immutable characteristics, things like that. I think that it's hard to kind of tease out that line. And ultimately, that's probably going to be the hardest part of being the editor-in-chief of the publication, is trying to figure out where that line is and ultimately, putting my foot down when necessary. I think that ultimately, when it comes to views that are just, I don't want to be a publication where people feel comfortable writing about genocide and kind of trying to make a defense for ethnic cleansing. I do want to be a publication that is open to people who might not necessarily say, hey, I want to do this to X group, but might, say, hey, I'm not necessarily sure I agree with laws that protect X group, for example, because I know there are plenty of libertarians who disagree with the Civil Rights Act. And, as a person of color, that might be very, very weird to hear it on at its face value. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's necessarily a threat to one's existence or calling for the end of one's existence. It's merely saying that, hey, a better outcome could emerge if we took this route rather than this route. When it comes to views where they're kind of just trying to say plainly people don't deserve to exist, or people are just I think there, I think there's a fine line. I think it's hard to kind of speak about it, but I definitely think that people know it when they see it.
So my next question for you is, how do you think you're going to go about like making sure that they go up to like a certain level of quality? Because I mean, I'm sure if you're like, you know, having a political review, the goal is to have like well thought out, fleshed out ideas. How would you go about this while also trying to maintain some sort of ideological neutrality?
I think that when it comes to the content of the pieces themselves, we don't want to be too strict. Obviously, the whole point is to have as many views as possible. I think it's more so the actual stylistic stylistic implications of the piece themselves. So, you know, if a piece is just totally just horribly written, like, you know, fragmented sentences and not well thought out ideas and just all these theses everywhere without any argumentation or supporting evidence, that's one where you'd say, okay, we can edit this without necessarily changing the content or changing the argument or changing the ideals being put forth. So I think that's the main difference ultimately.
So I want to push back on that a little bit. So I might not hold this belief, but some people seem to believe that structures like grammar tend to privilege certain types of arguments over other types of arguments and certain types of views over other types of views. Would that mean that your journal would have a sort of stance on coherence?
So I think that that's a really great question, because I have heard people kind of further those arguments before, particularly, you know, people of color in this country or certain, you know, ideological currents that claim themselves to be speaking on the behalf of marginalized people will say like, hey, grammar can oftentimes be, you know, marginalizing. And, you know, I hear those views and I don't necessarily agree with them, but I do think that if there's a case for kind of ignoring or looking the other way when it comes to certain standards that we would have in the editorial practice, then yes, we would look the other way. If there's like, you know, I don't want to just say, hey, we're going to look the other way when it comes to grammar, for example, just because someone doesn't feel like writing, you know, well that day. That's different than someone saying, hey, I'm going to write this piece in a non-traditional format with perhaps a lot of grammatical errors, because that's number one, my style. Number two, I might not necessarily agree that grammar, you know, is something that is neutral, for example. So people present a compelling argument, I guess, to the editorial board as to why their piece kind of errs from grammatical standards. That makes sense. If someone just comes about, you know, frolicking saying, hey, I'm just going to ignore every single editorial standard, and it really is jarring in contrast to the rest of the pieces we have, then we're going to have to think very long and hard about why we'd accept that piece. But ultimately, I think that we want to shoot for certain levels, like a certain level of quality, while also being respectful of what people perceive to be quality. Because some people's definition of quality might not necessarily be a traditional format or traditional prose. It might be something that's a little bit more jarring. But we want to be understanding. We want to incorporate those arguments into our process of editing the actual review itself.
But wouldn't that in itself challenge the idea of neutrality? Like, for example, maybe I have the belief that, like, making special type exceptions for certain types of arguments is deeply offensive and goes against the spirit of liberty. Would you be conducive to some of those views, or like, would your journal be conducive to some of those views?
Yeah. So when you say like
I'll give you a specific example. So like when we're talking about like grammar fundamentally being racist or something, I mean, I've heard the argument for the soft bigotry of low expectations that in doing so, this is something that like is deeply offensive. Do you think that has any credence in how you go about like maintaining a sort of fair editorial standards? Or do you think like which do you prioritize? Do you prioritize the relativism of maybe trying to include arguments, even if they aren't worded particularly well, more than like the sort of universality of like a common standard?
I think when it comes to kind of making like weighing those two standards, I think ultimately has to do with our goal as a publication. And our goal as a publication, number one, is to be something that allows for discourse to happen at MIT, provides a platform for people to speak about it, but also a platform for people to read about it. And I think that when things start to, you know, venture into the territory of unreadability, where it'll only be applicable or readable to a certain niche of the MIT population, then I think it kind of goes against our founding mission, which is to be something that allows people from all strokes of MIT to understand politics, to read about politics, to engage with politics. And I think that, you know, when you start tolerating certain types of I guess, editorial formats or pieces that are just go against every, I guess, standard that you would have in a traditional publication, then it does make it difficult for people, lay people, I don't want to say lay people, but like people who necessarily aren't necessarily well-versed in politics to actually read and understand. And I think that would make it kind of hard for us to deliver on that mission of making sure that people at MIT could read and understand if we don't ensure a certain level of journalistic quality. So it's a balancing act, definitely. But I think that when it comes to, you know, the grammar is racist side versus, hey, we need to uphold a certain level of, you know, quality and standards, then I would definitely lean on the upholding level, a certain level of quality and standards, because I do want to make it a publication that's open to certain writers, but I also want to make sure it's open to readers alike. So I want to make sure it's something that people can, you know, comprehend and tolerate, rather than having to like look up every single, you know, whatever it may be that those people hold themselves to when it comes to grammar standards. So I think it definitely, I would prioritize both, but readership is also definitely important.
Yeah. So regarding that, what sort of issues do you think would become more popular at MIT because of this journal? And right. What sort of issues do you think deserve to be in the mainstream, but are sort of neglected?
Right. Yeah. So I think that, you know, just, I don't want to give too much away from some of the writers who are currently working right now, but I do think that, you know, one of the areas that a few of the writers who are writing for publication are really interested in is definitely kind of almost, and it's hard to put this into words because it's a very, very esoteric approach to politics, but kind of reasoning about the morality of political science, the field itself. So, you know, I think that a lot of times we kind of just accept that it's okay to predict politics. It's okay to make all these statements about politics. You know, there are a lot of people who may disagree with that, who may, you know, say that, hey, is it really right for us to predict politics? Or what are the moral implications of us predicting politics? So I think a lot of these almost moralistic questions have to do with the field and the practice itself are definitely going to be game in the publication. I think that a lot of times we kind of just accept politics and we talk about like what the president's doing or what Congress is doing or this ideology or that ideology or this belief system. But I think it's also interesting to look at the practice and the field itself and almost critique political science as an umbrella field rather than just talking within the realms and within the boundaries of political science, but actually posing these kind of like meta questions about the field itself. So I think, you know, areas like that, I'm sure we'll see a lot of people talking about campus politics. There aren't many campus politics at MIT, but there's a lot of campus cultural politics that do happen where people, you know, may criticize the certain orthodoxies that exist on campus that are by definition political, but people don't really consider political. And I also think that we're going to see a lot of things that have to do with science as well and political implications of science, because a lot of people at the publication ultimately come from scientific backgrounds. And I think that's one thing that is under discussed in the media is a lot of the implications of a lot of the innovations that happen in this country. Because we're so, you know, we talk about tax bills, we talk about, you know, healthcare, we talk about, you know, foreign policy. Very under discussed is like technology and science policy. And I think that's one area the journal wants to hit on because of the relevant domain expertise that we have.
Okay, so hit me with some of these ideas. You're talking about like the science stuff. I know that your Facebook says that you're a futurist.
Right.
Could you explain to me the difference between maybe a futurist and a transhumanist and the sort of ethical and political differences?
Certainly. So back in high school, I was very much part of, I guess, the transhumanist current. I was very interested in this idea that, hey, maybe we don't have to be constrained by our biological truths. Maybe there is something more we can aspire to be. And we don't necessarily have to kind of cede ourselves to, you know, aging, death, things like that. I thought those were interesting ideas. As I grew theologically, I kind of started to drift away from transhumanism, which is, I guess, transcending the human body, transcending human biology and human just reality, and more towards a futurist current, which is that's less so transcending our body, but more so transcending the constraints of society itself, and doing things that necessarily push the boundaries of humanity forward. Not necessarily us human are like not necessarily us as humans, our human bodies, our human minds, but more so what humanity can achieve collectively. And I think that, you know, when it comes to futurism, it's definitely an area that I have not dabbled in enough over the last 2 years. I did a lot in high school, but since I got in college, I haven't really thought too deeply about it. But I think a lot of the things I would classify as future, like futurism, have less to do with pushing the boundaries of the human body itself and human existence itself, and more so human society, like what we can achieve when it comes to exploration of space, when it comes to you know, artificial intelligence, for example, things that have less to do with who we are and more to do with the society we want to create in the future. So I think that's the main difference I would tease out. And I would definitely put myself into the, latter camp rather than the former camp, because I do question, I would say almost I'm against this idea that we can, almost trick or circumvent the boundaries of nature as they are, as they pertain to humanity and themselves. I don't really find it interesting to talk about, can we move beyond death? I do think it's interesting to talk about, hey, can we extend the human lifespan? Can we make so people don't die as much? But I think when it comes to those existential constraints that we have, that humans have, like dying or being born, then I think those are areas that I've kind of receded from because of my theology. And I'm more interested in what we can do as a society.
Okay, so I want to know more about your theology. Are you like a deeply religious person, and how has that grown for you in the last couple of years since you've like heavily implied it, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, totally, totally. I am a religious person. I am Christian. I started off my life Christian. Went to church pretty often when I was younger. Probably less often than a lot of people who are religious in America, but to a fair degree. Come from a religious family as well. In high school, I started to question a lot of things, particularly when I was early on in high school. Ultimately, I think 9th or 10th grade, I probably would have classified myself at that point as an agnostic. I did start to lose my faith, or at least I started to believe less so in the dogma or the religiosity that we have in a lot of modern religions. And I started to believe more of like a naturalistic God, almost kind of bordering on deism. Eventually, though, I kind of started to recede, and I'm not entirely sure. It's probably a combination of different life events, different convictions, different things that have bubbled to the surface of my life to ultimately push me one way. But now I would class myself as someone who adheres to Christian doctrine, who believes in that doctrine, and believes in the teachings of the Bible. And I think it influences a lot of my life in terms of politics, in terms of my belief system. And a lot of people could say, like, hey, this my belief system influenced my politics, and ultimately that leads them to some like very bizarre end, like, thinking of like the theocrats of the world. I see mine more as a almost Christian humanism, where it almost influences my desire to see it improve, human condition, more human flourishing through peaceful means ultimately.
So do you think something like original sin can, I'm not religious by the way, but do you think that like something like original sin can largely be circumvented in a futurist society, and that like a lot of the vices that we currently see are a result of the society we live in?
I think that ultimately, when we have more in terms of technology, when we're able to consume more, when we're able to put our hands on more, I think it'll almost ultimately amplify those vices in a way. They may look different than the vices we have today, but ultimately, I think we're still going to succumb to our own pitfalls. I think ultimately, we're still going to succumb to a lot of the earthly temptations. Again, those earthly temptations are going to look very different in a society that does not have, a lot of things we're accustomed to today that's very advanced. But I think kind of succumbing to those carnal temptations and ignoring the transcendent is definitely going to be a feature of humanity, even in the future. I think that's only going to increase when we have more to put our hands on, more shiny objects, more ways to interface with the rest of humanity. Because right now, I think we're at a point in technology where we can talk to each other across distances as we're doing right now. But I think we're going to get to a point where we can do a lot more than that, and technology is going to bridge an even farther gap. And when it does that, I do think it's going to increase opportunities for us to succumb to carnal temptation. And ultimately, I think that it's going to make it so that even if we try, we're not going to really be able to circumvent the, intrinsic pitfalls as humans that come from original sin.
Yeah, so about that, do you think that like we have a strictly contained view on human nature that like, there's no such thing as utopianism, but we can get closer like to a better society? Do you
So
think
yeah.
that?
Yeah, so ultimately I think that, yeah, I definitely think we can get, to a better society. Maybe we can get to a society where, I ultimately my goal, I guess in life broadly, but my goal, or I think the goal of our society should be, is to definitely reduce suffering, human suffering. I think that, when it comes to utopia, ultimately as a Christian, I don't think we can get an earthly utopia, because I think, we're fallen people, fallen earth. I think that a lot of what we might aspire to when it comes to perfection, is reserved for the eternal salvation that is to come. I think, though, we can do as much as possible here on earth to reduce human suffering, to reduce conflict, to really live in the way that Jesus taught us to live, which is, love for one another, stewardship for our planet, reverence for the creation and ultimately doing good works as well. So I think that a lot of that can manifest itself politically, tangibly within societies. And ultimately, I think that what we do will ultimately reduce suffering and encourage flourishing. But I do think that achieving a perfect human society where we're free of a lot of the pitfalls, I think that it's just going to be, even if we get rid of a few pitfalls and we get rid of a few vices and we get rid of a few, you know, vulnerabilities of humanity, we're just going to create another one. And I think it's almost like this hydra where, you know, cut off one head, another one grows.
So what sort of books have influenced your political philosophy, and what sort of things do you think stay relevant to how you think about the world?
Yeah, totally. I think that ultimately, I know this is a very cliche answer from someone in my background, but ultimately, like, just reading the scripture itself is extremely influential for me. I always find something new that I just didn't have and discovered before that ultimately influences how I see that day. There's always some amazing impeccable teaching or parable or, you know, analogy for life, even though it was written many, many years ago. So I think that's definitely influenced my approach to things, my views on things. In terms of, other texts, I think that, reading various papal encyclicals from the last century has also been very illuminating. I haven't had a chance to read it, but Pope Francis's recent encyclical includes a lot of material that has to do with the present, I guess, challenges we have as a world, especially in the midst of, this pandemic that's gripped the entire world. So I think that reading from the papal encyclicals has done a lot to kind of almost enlighten my way as to how humanity should be ordered, how we should confront these challenges we have, whether they were the challenges in the early 1900s with economic devastation, the rise of nationalism, ultimately the war on the horizon, or whether it's today with, a lot of the same tides of nationalism, a lot of the conflict, a lot of the, sickness that we have. Ultimately, in terms of like philosophical books, I'm very much a person who, I aspire to read more philosophy. I aspire to read more about political philosophy. I haven't had the chance to do it. My life has been very STEM-centered for the longest time. But I think in terms of like STEM, like more, less philosophical books and more, I guess, books that you can encounter in a different sphere of life, I think that, reading science fiction books has definitely limited my way about the human condition itself, because there's this recurring theme in science fiction books, like, for example, I, Robot with Asimov. There's this recurring theme about humanity trying to, again, going back to our point, transcend itself, become better than itself. And ultimately that reveals itself to be itself a pitfall. You know, we try to do better. We try to get away from our, the constraints of humanity. And ultimately we just design a new way for us to fall from grace. So I think that, a lot of those texts have really influenced how I see the world, how I see the human nature and the human condition, and ultimately how I've come to understand what must be done or what actions we should take to reduce suffering, to increase flourishing, to get a better society at what we have right now.
Okay, so you mentioned like the Pope being pretty foundational to like how you're seeing current events. But is it not also true that like a lot of popes have been charlatans and hustlers? And right. How do you sort of reconcile that in terms of like ignorance? Like, right. For example, yeah. I think like Garry Kasparov is an amazing chess player, and I'm never going to be as good as him in chess. But also, I'm not always playing chess. And I feel like that same sort of thing can apply to religion. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that, ultimately, when you look at, you look at the popes, I'm not a Catholic, to preface. There was a lot of teachings of Catholicism that I don't necessarily adhere to. I think that when it comes to the teachings of the Pope, I have to look at the various popes, much like I'd look at myself, someone who tries to do good for the world and tries to put as much wisdom, whatever little wisdom I have at this young age, into the world, despite my pitfalls and despite my shortcomings as a human. I think that, a lot of popes have been men of their time, people who are, necessarily products of what the state of the world was back then. You had a lot of popes on the onset of the war who were ultimately, I wouldn't want to say victims of, but vulnerable to a lot of the tendencies and, thoughts that were, preeminent right before the World War II, like nationalism, for example. You saw a lot of religious scholars and a lot of religious figureheads also fall victim like Father Coughlin, who, you know, was someone who revered Hitler, for example. You know, these are men we're taught to learn from and taught to read from, but it's hard to reconcile that sometimes with their actions. But ultimately, I look at them much like I look at myself. I look at my friends and saying that these people can do good things and say good things and things that are influential and things that might necessarily apply to our lives, even if their actions may reflect in a different way. I hate the mantra, but I always try to divorce the actor from their personal life and their works. The same with the writer, same with the painter. Whatever personal shortcomings or blunders they've committed, I think it's ultimately, it's good for contextualizing what they have to say, but ultimately I don't think it's the totality of what they have to say. I think what they have to say is definitely something beyond who they are as a human. And ultimately they're flawed just like me. So it's hard for me to make those, you know, total judgments on them as well.
Yeah. And this is where I sort of want to push you. Like, it seems to me that like the Pope says a lot of really stupid things. He's gone to bat for pedophiles. You know, he argues for the most prominent vice we see in society, envy and redistribution. Like, I'm sure we probably don't share these as like the same right. values, but to me, it sounds like you're just sort of taking what you like from the Pope that you already like, and then just saying like, you know, this has some sort of like spiritual doctrine in it. Do you think that you'd like to see nations in the future be some form of Christian of which like relative to your interpretation of what it means to be Christian?
Right. Yeah. So on the topic of the Pope, yeah, I think there's a lot I agree with. And I think that just so happens to be the fact that, like, you know, we come from similar doctrinal influences. You know, a lot of what I believe in, it aligns with a lot of what the Pope believes. And, you know, as a result, as a byproduct, a lot of what he writes, puts out there ultimately does confirm, or not necessarily confirm, but does definitely mirror what I already believe. I think that what I gain a lot of is a lot of my beliefs are very, very, I want to say immature, but they're undeveloped still. They're still in a maturation phase, still trying to arrive at more concrete beliefs. I'm very much someone who goes through a lot of different changes in how they see the world, how they feel as politics should be used by humans. And I think the Pope offers perhaps a more developed, more refined version of the beliefs that I'm starting to come into. So like when he talks, for example, I've read some tidbits from the new encyclical. I haven't read it in its entirety, but I've seen tidbits. He talks a lot about how we should not fall into like parochial tendencies, but we should definitely understand that there is value in place. And that when it comes to, I guess, like internationalism, for example, it's hard to do internationalism without having a reverence for the local as well. So kind of the balance between the local and the global, and how, you know, it almost, you know, international necessitates a certain, you know, reverence for local, because local differences make it so that you have something to offer to the world. If everybody was the same, everybody was coming from the same place, people, nations would not have much to offer one another in terms of wisdom, in terms of gifts, in terms of culture, in terms of literature, in terms of everything that makes a nation, at the same time, we should not let those nation or almost nationalist tendencies overwhelm us and become preeminent in our lives. We should still seek to look outwards, not only inwards, but it's important to revere the inwards. So I think things like that, for example, I have those ideas percolating in my mind, but I don't necessarily know how to put them into words. I'm not necessarily sure how to really get the hold of those ideas. And I think he puts them in really great words, but also describes them and goes deeper than what my mind would necessarily conceive of. There are things I disagree with on the Pope, though. For example, when it comes to death penalty, I want to be strictly anti-death penalty, and certain parts of me definitely are anti-death penalty, but at the same time, I feel as though, you know, I'm sometimes willing to make exceptions. He is very much no death penalty. He reiterated in this most recent encyclical, death penalty being entirely at odds with our belief system. So there are definitely things that make me, that I like about reading papal encyclicals, because they challenge my beliefs and challenge, you know, my political socialization. But I think ultimately I read because I want to develop my own ideas. I want to kind of maybe look for ideas that might challenge my preconceptions. But ultimately I see him as a source of wisdom. And I think it's always good to read or drink from a fountain of wisdom.
Yeah. So like why a specific religious document as opposed to other ones? So for example, I've read parts of the Old Testament and I feel like there's some really interesting, insightful things, but I tend to be a little bit less interested in the New Testament, or I like the Zhangzi. Do you think that the sort of politics that your religion demands are conducive to other religions as well? And do you think there's such a thing as like a universal conception of a nation?
Right. Yeah. So I think that when it comes to, you know, my religious beliefs and kind of like the politics that it births, I think that a lot of perhaps Abrahamic religions or belief systems with strong legalistic backgrounds or foundations, definitely there's a lot of consensus and a lot of overlap. You know, I talked to one of my Jewish friends, and he's very, very orthodox in his faith. And, you know, we find ourselves agreeing on so much when it comes to politics, because I think we're coming from, you know, not the same source, but we're coming from sources that almost are analogous to one another. And ultimately, like, you know, my faith, the Old Testament, for example, you know, that's Abrahamic. So I think that there's a lot of overlap between, you know, my views, people for who subscribe to other Abrahamic faiths, or faiths that are not necessarily Abrahamic or rooted in that tradition, but more so legalistic in the sense that they're very concerned about, you know, norms, order, concerned with the common good, which is not necessarily unique to Abrahamic religions or Christianity by any measure, but definitely can be seen in belief systems across the world. There are certain belief systems in like tribal Africa, for example, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, that I think are very, I don't, almost reminiscent of my belief system. Like I forget which country it was and which tribe particularly within that country, but they have like a tribal chieftain, and a lot of the goods, for example, like the land, there's a lot of mutual ownership over things in that tribe. And oftentimes people within that tribe, not necessarily being blood related, see themselves as kin. I think there's a lot of, you know, lessons to be drawn about a society that views one another as kin, views all of us as belonging to almost to the same tribe rather than as part of different competing tribes. And I think that when we look at this tribal solidarity that we see in certain tribes in Africa, there's a lot of lessons to draw upon, even though it's not necessarily a Christian belief. You know, this idea of mutual obligation that a lot of these tribes have, this idea that, you know, we should be rendering unto one another as if we were brothers and sisters of all the same. I think there's a lot of important lessons to be gleaned from that. So I think that any belief system that kind of puts at its forefront, you know, common good, you know, mutual obligation is definitely something that kind of fits into my political ethos, even if it necessarily isn't from the same religious background as mine.
Yeah. How do you center that with challenging of interpretations and stuff? Because to me, it feels like something like freedom or liberty seems to stand in some way, and I'm not saying completely, of course, mm-hmm. but like in some way against this idea of this collective. Do you buy into that? Do you think that like liberty helps or hurts what it means to be like a part of a community?
Totally. I think that you know, I'm one who believes that ultimately, like, you know, I kind of guess I subscribe to like almost traditional you know, Christian view of liberty as being something within the context of another thing, ultimately like an ordered liberty of sorts, where it's not necessarily this ability to kind of just, you know, it's not necessarily pure self-interest and pure pursuit of self-interest, but more so a certain freedom within the context of other things. I think that liberty is important. Ultimately, it is an important value. I think it's a value we should aspire to. I feel as though, you know, people should be unchained. People should be free to do within their will. I think that people should be not necessarily, you know, legally obliged to do certain things and render certain goods. I think, however, liberty is important within in a contextual sense where, you know, it's hard to say liberty is a good thing when it's unmoored from necessarily everything else in the world. Like if it's unmoored from our cultural norms, if it's unmoored from legal norms, if it's unmoored from, you know, tribes, nation, whatever it may be, family, when liberty is unmoored from all these things that root us, then I think it can ultimately be at odds because it's, I guess, antithetical to the rootedness and almost the solidarity mindset that I include in a lot of my beliefs politically and theologically. But I think that liberty within a certain order, within certain norms, within a certain background or subtext, ultimately is something that we should be aspiring towards. But I think I'd subscribe to like this ordered liberty versus like other forms of liberty that you might see You know, I'm not super savvy when it comes to libertarianism and the teachings of libertarianism, but some currents that you might see there could be potentially at odds with this idea of solidarity and mutual obligation.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that in particular with regards to human rights.
Right.
Does your Christian faith place a premium on human rights, or does it see that as part of being a part of a community? Like, human rights necessarily exist not as like independent things, but as a result of the sort of orders you're in. And they change over time, right?
Right, exactly. So I think that, you know, when it comes to human rights, I don't necessarily think it's like this idea that, you know, we should put the rights of humans, their self-agency, self-ownership at the forefront. I think that I don't necessarily see it as being at odds, you know, with these belief systems. I think, you know, personally, as a, you know, political person who's inclined to involve themselves in politics and engage in politics, I think that human rights is definitely at the forefront of what I believe. And I think that, like, you know, when you don't have human rights, then it definitely afflicts the common good. You know, when people are rendered subservient to others, if they're rendered in servitude to others, if they lose that agency, if they lose that ability to be a free individual, then I think it ultimately hurts the common good. I think that, you know, if you look at the historical examples, if you take like a probabilistic viewpoint, just seeing what happens in humanity when human rights are abridged, it almost always leads to a state or a society where people are by and large unhappy, suffering is ultimately increased, and flourishing is ultimately impeded. I think that just looking at it from historical context, I think that if you don't value human rights, if you don't value people and their ability to just be comfortable within themselves and live as they are, rather than trying to necessarily, you know, abridge certain aspects of themselves, or, you know, I want to say render themselves in servitude to others, then you have societies where they can't, you know, achieve or attain their maximal flourishing. And ultimately societies where we're very far from what's essential and what I would conceive as the common good.
Yeah, so it seems to me that you're arguing that human rights are not necessarily goods in and of themselves, but they're majorly instrumental to allowing human flourishing.
Right. So, so I think that, So I think that ultimately, I think that human rights are almost like a subsect of this idea of the common good, which is, you know, a good that is of the highest good and a good that is as common as possible and as far reaching as possible. I think that human rights is a subsection. I think human rights is important for achieving that common good. I think that ultimately, you know, human rights is an end of itself. I think that purely on value terms alone, human rights is a net positive. It's good. I think that, you know, if you don't have rights for people, people's rights are abridged, and you get all types of monstrosities, you get autocracies, you get, you know, all these forms of human ordering and humans, you know, organization that ultimately lead to people, you know, ultimately having their very humanity questioned, their very humanity deprecated. So I think that it is a good of itself to value human rights and pursue human rights. And I think that ultimately our pursuit of human rights does raise the bar and does lead to flourishing. And I think it does lead us to attain the common good. Because if you can't achieve a common good, if so many people are locked out or cordoned off from that common good, if they're cordoned off from contributing to that common good and the totality of their existence, the life energy is in service to somebody else against their will, against their, against their existence. I think that cuts people off. And by definition, you can't achieve a common good when so many people are locked out of it and forbidden from accessing it.
Yeah. Something that I'm thinking about in this specific context is female genital mutilation.
Right.
I work with the Ion for CLE Foundation. And
nice.
One big thing that happens in like a lot of really collectivist and arguably dignified in most ways, like African tribes and or like there's still some problems in the United States, but like it's especially prominent in like places like Yemen. Like you see, like there's these strong solidarity and strong bonds within this group, but there's also like human rights atrocities that are going on at a young age. Do you think that it is always possible to tease out like getting rid of human rights with challenging collectivism? Like, are you seeing where I'm saying like there might be like a little bit of a dilemma? Like sometimes this like shared suffering from hazing might end up leading to the solidarity in question. Do you think that solidarity is more important or less important? Or do you think it just depends on the case?
Right. Yeah. I think it's almost a case by case. I think it's a what type of solidarity it is. Like, if it's solidarity out of, you know, there are many ways we can come to value one another and come to depend on one another. And if the way we, like, for example, through hazing, I'm out of the idea that, or the belief that that's a particularly strong foundation of solidarity. You know what I mean? Like, I think that if the foundation itself is shaky, if our, the extent of our solidarity is because we attend the same program, or we just happen to be in the library at the same time, and, you know, something traumatic happens, like, I don't think it's particularly strong solidarity. I'm not sure it's one that we should definitely, I don't think it's one we should be celebrating. I think that solidarity by happenstance out of negative events isn't necessarily one we should say, hey, this is great. Like,
okay, so I'm gonna refine the view to be a little bit more palpable from a view perspective. So, like, a big aspect of, like, some of these tribes is this idea of, like, collective ownership. And that includes collective ownership of the women. Right. And what sort of autonomy, sexual or not, that women have.
Right.
I'm wondering how, like how much at odds do you see human rights and solidarity? Because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, I would very strongly want to impose my idea of the good on people who are doing something that I see as against human rights, even though that might bring them a sort of solidarity. Do you think that there's, like, a minimalist view of what human rights have to be in order to even achieve this solidarity?
Totally. Yeah. So I think that when it comes to, yeah, I honestly think there is definitely, like, a standard for human rights that, to, like, in order to achieve solidarity, we do have to have a minimum level of human rights. And if you're abridging people's rights, if you're taking, like, if you're mutilating their genitals, for example, if you're ownership over one person, that is by definition abridging their human rights. And I don't think you can achieve that solidarity, because I think for solidarity to come about, you have to realize that, you know, while people play their own unique roles in society, we all should be coming to the playing field, I want to say, as equals almost, in the sense that, you know, you shouldn't have ownership over me. I shouldn't have ownership over you. And if I do have ownership over you, you have ownership over me, then we're not necessarily coming to the field as equals. There's a power imbalance. And
well, I don't think that, I mean, though,
that genuine solidarity can come about if it's by force, if it's by, you know, mashing people together and saying, hey, you have to be one, you have to feel communal obligations. Or if it's taking somebody from a different tribe, enslaving them and saying, you're a part of this tribe now, you have to render your services under this tribe, there's solidarity. I think that's, number one, a shaky foundation of solidarity, but number two, also kind of a artificial solidarity. And I think that the best form of solidarity that ultimately achieve the ends that I would like to see oftentimes come about organically and in a way that does not force or impose on somebody else, and also respects their personhood and, I guess, their individual liberty itself.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask about another example. It's a little bit further away from the topic at hand, which is, like, are you familiar with the Japanese prosecutorial system at all?
Actually, I'm not.
Okay, so, like, a big thing that goes into place is that there's, like, a strong honor culture in Japan. Mm-hmm. And if a prosecutor brings a case against you, it's considered extremely dishonorable to defend the person at hand.
Oh, wow.
Do you think that, like Japan is a very, like, trusting and open society in a lot of ways, but right. It does have this sort of, like, deal with the devil in that, like, procedural rights are sort of undermined. Is that particularly important? And do you think creating, like, these strong social mores is acceptable in the name of, like, solidarity or cultural norms?
So I think that, you know, the reason I value solidarity is ultimately the same reason a lot of people value other, I guess, abstractions like democracy or like liberalism, in the sense that it leads to what we believe to be the good life for humans. It leads to a good end, right? And I think that when solidarity becomes the end itself, rather than almost a proxy for achieving the common good, achieving human flourishing, achieving the good life, then I think we have to question the solidarity at hand. I think that, you know, trying to establish certain levels of social trust, as Japan has done through their various institutions, I think is, you know, social trust is something we should strive for, because I think we have a lot of distrust in society, ultimately we have a lot of conflict. But I think that if that social trust is predicated upon faulty, shaky, or maybe even, might I say, even kind of autocratic or authoritarian grounds, then I think we run the risk of, again, the same conflict that would come as a result of distrust coming about as a result of trust. You know, you look at, for example, you know, Nazi Germany under Hitler, they were trying to create an artificially, like, they were trying to create all forms of artificial solidarity and all forms of artificial social trust. And ultimately it decays in conflict because it's not organic and it requires you to abridge the rights of somebody else and to trample on their very humanity. So I think that, again, when solidarity comes about in an organic form, and it leads to, and it's hard to quantify what leads to human flourishing, but when it leads to human flourishing, then I think it's something we should value. But if it's something that's constructed artificially, superficially, and leads to negative ends, then we have to really consider whether or not what we're doing in that sense is the best way to do it. Kind of like democracy. If democracy is leading to like autocratic, populist, demagogic outcomes, then I think we have to question the actual system itself. But we value it because by and large, it leads to the best outcomes for humanity. I think the same thing goes for solidarity.
So what about like if somebody like me comes along and is like, yeah, solidarity is not really that important of a social value. It tends to lead to people being stuck in terrible positions, hating their neighbors, blah, blah, blah. Do you think that there's any value to like extreme dissidence in terms of viewing this sort of thing?
Right. I think it's also always good to question, you know, I guess I would say that.
Because
you know,
like to me, it seems like solidarity by nature is sort of creating things that are supposed to be unquestionable in certain ways.
Right.
Like you know, like the sacred value of solidarity by nature is a sort of sacredness.
Right. Exactly. So I think that, you know, as many things, I think questioning is important for improvement. I think that, the values and tenets of solidarity as we conceive of them today could be very different from how we conceive of them in the future. And we may conceive of better forms, different forms of solidarity because people have come along and questioned them and perhaps suggested alternative ways to get there. But I think the idea of humans having some sort of fraternal connection with one another, some reverence one another, ultimately is good. I think it's good to question the methods by which we get there. I think it's good to question the outcomes that emerge from that fraternity. But I think that ultimately, by and large, when we feel a certain, I don't want to necessarily say obligation, but when we feel a certain connection to one another, when we feel a certain reverence for one's personhood, and we feel a certain level of trust in one another, that I think that that's something we should aspire to as values. It's ultimately a question, how do we get there? And I think that's where the questioning comes in, and the questioning is important. And people should feel free to question those beliefs themselves. That, you know, does us feeling trust towards one another actually result in good outcomes? That's a totally valid question to ask. I'm of the belief that it definitely does, and I see it, I feel it in my life with my family, my community. But other people might feel differently. And I think it's important to question, because if we question things, we can get to better outcomes and ultimately a better standard. If people are willing to offer alternatives that may be improvements upon what's existing right now.
Yeah, my last question area for you is, you've mentioned you've gone sort of around the political compass, so to speak, and yeah. you're at like a position that's sort of antithetical to mine. How did you get there, and what sort of things would maybe push you in a different direction?
Right, totally. Yeah, you're right. Totally. I have shifted across the political compass. I started off, like I said, I may have mentioned this, but I'm not sure. Started off as kind of like a bog standard, you know, left liberal, someone who was very fervently support, you know, just kind of like mainstream Democratic Party, ideas like that, probably a little bit more liberal in terms of social views. But pretty much mainstream Democratic Party when I was younger. I would say what pushed me into the libertarian quadrant, what made me become libertarian for a very long period, was because I saw the failings of government. I saw the failings of government in the United States. I saw the failings of government as it pertained to my own community. I thought that necessarily, I didn't think the problem was, you know, the actions of government. I thought the problem was government in and of itself. I think it was just fatally flawed, and there was nothing we can do to reform it. So the best thing we can do is to reduce the scope and size of it, so we can be left our own devices and ultimately do what's best for us in our own self-interest. I was someone who, it was very much an American context. I thought, you know, I was very libertarian in the sense that I opposed government because I saw what happened in the American government. I saw things the American government had done. Just looking at historical examples, like criminal justice is one reason that pushed me to become a libertarian in the first place, because I saw the carceral system. I saw how justice was applied unfairly and unevenly. I saw, you know, people having the rights deprecated for what I thought were arbitrary reasons. And I say, hey, this is not legitimate. You can't do that. And the fact that it does happen so often, it's only enlarged and become more frequent, this criminal justice system we had that I feel as though is illegitimate in some regards. The fact that it's become even bigger and it's encroached on more and more people, I thought was evidence of a government that ultimately, when you have one, it's just going to want to become bigger and bigger and fester and consume more and more, no matter how legitimate it is or not. That's what really pushed me to become a libertarian in the first place. I guess what pushed me out of that quadrant and pushed me to more of where I am right now is definitely this idea.
Just to clarify, your economic right upper or economic left upper?
Economic left upper. So I'm economic.
You just like zigzagged across.
Yeah, I did like a diagonal. I guess what pushed me there ultimately was, I gradually realized and I gradually came to the belief that a lot of what happens to libertarianism, or I guess the libertarians I was interacting with at that point, kind of ignored a lot of the externalities that happen in society. And I felt that, it is really good to, this idea that, I'll do me, you do me, you do you, so long as you don't hurt me and you don't, abridge my ability to do what I want to do. I thought that was a really good value, and I thought that was a really good way to live life. But then I started to realize that, sometimes the things I do in my own, my private life, the things I do, by myself as an individual may have second order effects on people around me. I feel a society is a collection of individuals. It ultimately is the sum of those individuals. I think that when one person starts to, for example, a good analogy would be an orchestra. When someone starts playing off key or the wrong note, it just messes up the entire piece. You can hear it too. Like you hear a beautiful, beautiful piece of classical music and you just hear all this jarring, this cacophony. And you're like, this doesn't sound good. This doesn't make me feel good. I think the same thing ultimately can be applied to society when the constituent pieces of society start acting perhaps even against each other or in discord, then it's hard for us to achieve the things that we should be achieving in society, which are a common good, which should be pushing the boundaries of human existence to become better. And I think that in order for us to do it, we have to revere ourselves not as individuals who are isolated and disjointed, but rather as a part of something greater than ourselves. And we should be in the pursuit of something that is beyond just the sum of these individuals, but something that exceeds that some of the individuals within a society. So I think that, ultimately this idea that, our actions do manifest in other, and like our actions do have an effect on others, because of the act, because ultimately, for example, if you're in the orchestra, start playing horribly, it's going to reflect poorly on the people who are playing in your orchestra, even if they're playing the right note. That's kind of how I see society, in the sense that even the things I do privately ultimately can have negative effects on society, which will ultimately have negative effects on individuals within the society. So I think it's ultimately important to have some type of governing code, so to speak, that orders the individuals in society towards some higher ideal that isn't just material self-interest and individual pursuit, but is something that's more common than my individual aspirations and my individual convictions. And that's kind of how I started to go in that direction. And just also seeing the state of the world, I have a lot of experiences with, like, for example, the United States healthcare system, and it's made me very antagonistic towards a lot of the not necessarily the tenets of libertarianism, but I guess the practical policy recommendations that come out of libertarianism. I started to say, hey, I feel as though these aren't necessarily good policy recommendations. I think these might actually worsen the problems. I think ultimately we just need to put up, shut up, and just try to do what seems to work elsewhere, and we'll ultimately reduce the amount of human suffering we have in this country because of the material scarcity, because of the state of the world and state of the United States. We need to try to just chart a different path forward that doesn't necessarily make the problem worse, but tries to build upon what's already there and mirror what other countries have done with their schemes and their public organization.
Yeah, but going back to like the issue of human rights with this sort of thing, like you might give the example of something like drug use as an example of like disharmony that comes right out. But another one that I think is really interesting is the issue of divorce. Mm. In that, like, when people are unfaithful to their partners and treat each other with a lot of disrespect, there oftentimes are, like, serious consequences to that. But at the same time, I feel really bad about the idea of regulating other people's lives with that. Because right. I also don't know if, like, the government would be able to solve the problem better. Do right. you ever feel that way?
That's something I've always kind of, I ultimately think that, and I think this might be a point where we might actually overlap in our beliefs, in the sense that, I guess from a consequentialist perspective, I think that, it might be good. The intention might be good for the government to resolve these disputes, to make it so that people aren't at odds with one another, to make it so that unions don't fall apart. I always question what happens with what the actual outcomes are when the government does intervene. You know, the government, the road to hell is paved with good intention. The government could be having the best intentions in mind, but they might not necessarily have the right tools or be the right people to actually solve an issue. And so one big belief that I'm actually an adherent to is subsidiarity, where like I believe that a lot of affairs, a lot of, you know, things that happen within society should be devolved to its lowest level, ultimately. Like I think that, you know, when it comes to personal matters, you know, that's something the federal government needs to necessarily intervene in. It could be something as small as your family or your community being that kind of state, almost the regulator, so to speak. And I think that a lot of the things that we do at the federal level and a lot of the, you know, actions of the government ultimately probably shouldn't be done by the federal government, shouldn't be done at the upper echelons of government, but rather should be kicked back to, you know, localities, communities, families, states, depending on what the actual magnitude of the problem at hand is. Because I'm not of the belief that just because the government can do something, it's going to do it well. So I think that we definitely have a lot of overlap there in the sense that, you know, it's better to decentralize ultimately, and that, you know, just because the government can do something doesn't mean it should do something by virtue of being government.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for an elucidating and lucid conversation.
Likewise. Thank you. I really appreciate it.